the show.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to this week's show. Happy New Year. I hope yours was very fun and safe. We are on to our second week of Best of Shows here as we round out the Boundless calendar year and enter 2013. Hopefully you enjoyed last week's show. We did put it together with you guys in mind, and this week's show is no different. We hope you'll find it very fun as well. Later on in the show, our inbox, the one that we decided to use, is on what to do if you are a Christian nice guy. Our culture segment is my interview with Wes Stafford. Remember when I talked to him, it totally blazed me away. He's the president of Compassion International. What a wonderful guy. And then our roundtable is on men and the church. Blast from the past. This is from earlier on this year where we talked about guys and some of their frustrations with the way church is done and how we can reconcile that and how we can move ahead and really how the church can serve men and how men can step up within the church as well. So we hope you are sharing these shows with your family and friends and that you are ready to complete your first week of January and head into the rest of the year. Enjoy the show, and we'll see you back next week when we start up the year with all new content. I'm very pleased to have Glenn here. Glenn, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Glenn is Focus's expert on gender, I would say, especially as it relates to family. He's our resident researcher and always has much to say on these kind of trends and very much authored a number of things related to that as well. So we're very pleased to have him here. Of course, we have to bring Travis Williams into the fray. Travis, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much. Always good to be here.
Travis, always. As our resident guy who loves sharing opinions. So he is...
I have no credentials.
You can just sense.
But he gets paid for it.
He does,
so
I know.
He's a professional.
You can just sense by me introducing these two guys that today we're going to be talking about men. And then there's just Martha and I. And Martha
just
and I
us.
Are just befuddled. Yep. We're just... That's what we're here to share.
Yeah.
It's just our befuddlement.
Curious to hear what they have to say.
Exactly. So the reason being, Martha, tell us about this article that was just published yesterday on the site.
Well, it's called Where Have All the Men Gone by David Murrow, and he's the author of a book called Why Men Hate Going to Church. And this book, I think, was published a few years back, was recently revised, and had heard about it from a publicist and asked them, do you think he'd be willing to write up an article specifically for our audience of college age to 30-somethings, mostly single? And so this article was the result of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is going to be interesting. When I read this article, I was like, oh, my word, here we go again. We're just going to stir people up. And I thought, I mean, just in the first reading, I was like, there are at least four categories of people that are going to be offended by this article, which I love. I love offending people here at the Bummer Show. This is, this is
sure
what we do.
Pass it on to your friends who will be offended.
We are not. Yeah, exactly. Please help us find more categories of people because four
right.
is not enough.
Yeah.
That's what I say. So this is going to be fun. A great show to tape on today, which is actually the anniversary of the first airing of the first episode of The Boundless Show back in January 2008.
Wow.
We have made it 4 years. Yes, so we are excited excited to be here. So that is a privilege
no
for you guys.
No run-ins in the law with the law and all that time?
Not That's yet. Well, good. We've have had a couple near misses.
Good.
But, but so far, we're good. The FCC hasn't shut us down or anything, so that's good. All right, so let's launch.
Stick around.
Yes, let's launch right into this article. Those of you that are out there, pull it up on the site if you haven't read it already, because you're going to want to refer to it as we are discussing it. Many of you probably have already read it. But basically, let's just talk about the premise of this article. David is saying that the church, really, I think he identifies in the last 30 years, for the most part, has started trending towards being an unsafe place for men. No, I won't say. I just want to make you guys sound super desperate and sad. No.
Yeah, well, that's where men want to go, is to the unsafe place, right? So that theory breaks
that
down.
Actually, yeah. That actually would do well for them. But he basically sets up a system where he describes these two filters that he believes are filtering out or shaking out men out of the church. And he begins by talking about the Sunday school structure and then moving into the youth group structure. And he basically says that by the time a guy is 18, seen. If he's survived that gauntlet of ministry at the church, then he's doing pretty well, but he's now in the minority. Of course, talking about Sunday school, where the way that Sunday school is set up, it trends towards the strengths of women. So being able to sit still, being able to listen to long stories, being able to work with their hands, being able to do crafts. And then youth group moves into this large group experience that centers on emotion, sharing your feelings, singing long praise and worship sets. So he feels like, you know, here we are now faced with a church that's run by women, that is geared towards women, and what are the men going to do about it? Mm. So first, Rian, you guys have read this article. First thoughts.
Maybe a little bit strong right off the bat, but I think that he's asking some fantastic questions and brings up some questions that maybe we should be looking at as we look at how we lead and grow men within the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think just the question of what is it about men is always a good question because, you know, clearly men and women are different and we need to ask the question, how are men and women different? And I do appreciate him bringing up some of the points and some of the differences of men and women, but a lot of the points that he makes that you just made are not endemic to the church. They're endemic to elementary school education. You know, the kid has to sit there and be quiet while the teacher talks. They have to do arts and crafts kinds of stuff. And so it's not even so much as I see it a problem with the church necessarily as it's a social problem with what do we do with boys and what do we do with girls and how do we not treat them exactly the same. Mm-hmm. It is interesting. I mean, and this is not a recent phenomenon either, that Rodney Stark in his wonderful History of the Christian Church talks about in the early weeks and days and months and years of the church appealed more to women. Not because they sat quietly and did crafts, but there's something about spirituality that just simply appeals more to women than it does to men. And I think that's an important distinction about women and men that we need to be aware of. So this is not a recent phenomenon, but it is a current phenomenon that has existed as long as there have been men and women. And so we in the church need to be aware of that, about what are the differences in men and women and how do we appeal to those differences and cater to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems also that women gravitate more towards being able to latch onto administrative type things. And churches have been maybe overly, some would say, administered in recent decades, where there are a lot more programs, committees. You know, there's the flower committee, there's the nursery, all these things that women are wanting to jump in and get their hands dirty, and they know how to do this and that. But if you look at, not looking at the early church, but I know David Murrow talks a lot about the model of Christ and how he had his guys, you know, and he had these disciples and he poured into them and then they in turn had to pour into others and they were able to preach and teach. And I know David talks about the value of hierarchy for men. Do you think that's been lost in today's church?
I do think. I mean, that's one of the big problems with just men generally is, and this is curious, women just left to themselves will develop into good women, more responsible women, just naturally for various reasons. And we could talk about that. But men have to be taught how to lead. They have to be encouraged how to lead. They had to be welcomed into leadership. And I don't think we're doing that today. We're not taking young boys and saying, okay, we need to make men out of you. And I think that's the large reason for the man problem today, is that we have to be very intentional about man-making, man-creating. And I can hear all the women saying, absolutely. I mean, it doesn't just naturally happen. It happens more naturally with women than it does men.
Mm-hmm. So is this because we don't have men in the church who are willing to make men? I mean, Travis, you've talked about this, about your youth group experience and how you had a guy who was just totally ripped leading your youth group. And so all the guys were like, dude, I want to go hang out with him because he's cool. Do we just not have cool guys in the church? Where are they?
I think to Glenn's point, there probably are some cool guys, but there's also a pressure, I think, from a church context to be like, you know what, we can have the fun and games in youth group, but there's such a divide that when they get into big church, that it's different. So let's try and make big church, or like, let's try and train our kids to experience big church at younger and younger ages. So moving into the larger corporate worship times, the more, hey, everything's happening on stage, which is very similar to most of our churches, and losing some of that intentionality that Glenn was just talking about. So yeah, my youth group leader, when I was growing up, he was a big, buff, ripped guy that the guys liked. But there was more to it than that. There was kind of that intentional direction that he gave, and we gravitated to him because of his characteristics, not only physically, but as a godly man. But he also instilled a lot of stuff in us. I mean, would challenge us, push us up against the wall in a good man way and say, look, what are you doing? And that was encouraging. And I think that's the piece that as guys and churches are looking at making this great, awesome corporate experiences of worship, there's, I would say there's probably less of that intentionality of the one-on-one relationships going on with leaders.
And see, with men, I mean, that's typically what we tend to do in the church today is like, hey, we've got this great guy youth group leader, and then we talk about some angle. Okay, he's either buff, he weightlifts, or he was in professional sports, or he's a musician. Well, you know, yeah, there has to be some angle, and he's super cool, and he's super funny. Rather than kind of what you're talking about with this guy is, yeah, he was a weightlifter, but there was a centeredness in his godliness.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, he knew where the center of the road was. And we don't have as many men like that. And the men that we do have, I think, unfortunately, are not called to leadership because they don't have that kind of personality star character to them. Whereas is we need to call that out of men and say, you know what, this is the guy that you need to follow. This is the guy that you need to emulate.
Okay, but do we have to, and this is where I take issue a little bit with what David's saying, is he seems to think that these are only the alpha male types. So he talks about, and this is where, you know, we're literally going to have guys fly off the handle with him saying, the guys that women want to marry, which he basically describes as this alpha male type, are not in churches because they're trending out because of all this structure stuff. So who is left?
Well,
his heart.
Let's dig right into that.
This is going to be good, yes.
Are what he terms the Bible geeks, the musical, the asexual. I mean, he like he creates this list that basically like
the predators,
makes all the predators. I mean, it's like he lumps in these guys and makes them all sound like freaks. I mean, just because you're bookish or you're musical, does that mean that you're not godly? I mean, what do you guys think about
that? Well, Lisa, I mean, the question that I just have immediately is which one of these is David? Because I assume that he hung in there through the church, right? And I think that's the problem is empirically, it makes for a good article, but it doesn't hold itself out. Because first of all, I think the alpha male thing is just a misnomer, you know, in the sense of, okay, we would all like to aspire to that. But really, many times the alpha male guy is the guy who is compensating for insecurities within himself. You know, it's just the quiet guy. It's the guy who's self-assured, who doesn't have to, you know, flex his chest and, you know, oh, I'm so into cage matches and things like that. I mean, it's you find that it is more of an insecure masculinity than the real masculinity that I think most young guys are really looking for.
Yeah. But at the same point, you know, and this is where I love to have as many people comment and bring their questions, because he starts off this article, ladies, I feel your pain, and then brings in these categories of guys. I mean, ladies, you're the ones who will know. I mean, is these the type of guys that you're finding in church today? And are those the kind of guys that ultimately you want to be with?
I think part of the pain is like the lack of numbers. That's what I probably hear most from other single women that I know. It's just, where are they?
And that's so true. I mean, I think it is true. You really do see. I think one thing that he says that is true here is that literally by the time you hit young adulthood, by the time you hit the college groups and certainly the singles groups, you're seeing at least a 60-40 ratio, women to men. So some of these guys have exited. That's just a fact.
And see, again, I think if you pick out any year from the church, you'll find that that has been the case. And it's not just endemic to Christianity. It's endemic to Judaism and Islam, although Islam is a little different there. I think it connects a little bit more with men. But religiously, women just tend to connect with the faith community more than men do. And so I think that's one mistake that he makes in his article is, okay, this is an endemic problem with Christianity and modern Christianity itself. It can be in some ways, but I think it's not exclusive or unique to Christianity. It's certainly not unique to today.
So what would you say to women who are thinking, where have all the men gone?
And
that still leaves a problem. Exactly. For the ladies.
Well, it does.
What you're saying is that I'm always going to have the odds stacked against me as a female. and there's just not enough guys.
Mm-hmm. Do you settle for someone that doesn't go to church?
And because I have people tell me, well, Lisa, you need to go outside the church then to find guys. Seriously? Like, seriously. I mean, where's the responsibility of godly men to just say, okay, my church is a little squirrely, but I'm going to stay in it, and I'm going to get into leadership, and I'm going to change my need. I think it's giving guys a cop-out to just say, well, I'm going to have this 10-year wasteland during my 20s because I can't handle it, so I'm going to go and play my djembe around a campfire, you know, for 10 years, and then maybe get back into church.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well,
defend
I do
yourself.
Think, I mean, the poor brother David, I mean, the one part that I agreed with in his article, and I think he was exactly right.
I agreed
right,
with you a few more points, David.
was the God has this perfect mate for me idea.
Yeah.
This soulmate thing, which I think is absolutely has no biblical basis whatsoever. And this idea of settling, I mean, that has been an interesting discussion. And I wouldn't say I agree with it, but I do think there is like, okay, so what does God have for you in a man? I love the quote from, you know, an older man of God who said, we always marry the wrong person. This idea that marriage is about two imperfect people coming together and forging out a life with one another. The other big, big thing is the idea of, and this has been true since the beginning of time, the way that women create better men out of imperfect men. You know, I say this all the time. Gather a stadium full of couples married 40 years or more and ask the women if your guy was the ideal guy when you married him. Mm-hmm. They'll know what you're asking, and everyone will laugh because the women will know that it wasn't true, and the men will know that it wasn't
true.
So
are you saying to marry a guy, a loser in the church or a loser outside of the church?
See,
what are you saying?
Or just a loser.
You know what? Every woman is going to marry a loser, okay? Marry a loser within the church and understand that it has always been the woman's place in a way, and this is a radical statement, but has always been the woman's place to help her man become the man that he needs to be. It's not solely her job. Way back when, the military helped do that. College helped do that. Bosses helped do that. But women played that role very significantly. And having children played that role very significantly in the lives of men.
Mm-hmm. But to Martha's point, where then, if these guys are timing out of church and literally are exiting youth groups just spiritually weak because they've had such a weak experience, at what point do they come back and even are in a position to be marriageable? Because I think that's what our problem is we're having to wait for these guys to get into their 30s and have some kind of radical experience, or have fallen off the wagon, gotten into who knows what for 10 years, and then all of a sudden we have to like reclaim them. I mean, where is the continuum broken?
Well, I think there's definitely a felt need that's going on there. And I would say that even the guys that are left, let's say that David's case has some sort of truth to it. The guys are gone and the guys that are left. What I'm seeing is some of the guys that are left are even not marryable. They've kind of moved into, let's say, the asexual camp. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's just really offend people.
Or like David says, the awkward, the ones who hang around because women will be kind to them.
Yeah.
You know,
or they're just, they're hands off. They're like, and I see what we're seeing from Boundless listeners is guys, they see even a handful of guys, but the guys aren't even seem interested in the ladies. So what are we doing to the earlier point, and how do we start equipping men to be men and the kind of men that ultimately many of our Boundless listeners, let's face it, even Boundless is symptomatic of this. I would say that right now listening, we've probably got, 70% women and maybe 30% guys listening?
Yeah, I don't know. I think we're closer than that.
Okay,
everybody count off.
But okay, so now let's talk to Travis's point, because maybe the men are not in the church because they're trying to find, you know, they're all trying to get married or trying to be in relationships and stuff, and they're just meeting these frigid women, as David Murrow says, the super virginity movement, which basically blazed Martha and I away. We're like, okay, there went 20 years of our lives, you know, doing what we thought was right. Mm-hmm. So what's your response to that, you guys, as far as, like, not that it's right, but do you think guys are literally going outside the church because they feel they're in a paradigm that's not allowing them to be men or to exercise healthy sexuality or pursuit or what?
I don't think they're going outside the church to look for mates. I think they're going outside the church for a whole lot of other reasons. You know, sports, college, careers, those kinds of things. I think there's a lot of women who go, you know what, I don't think a lot of guys are pursuing college and careers, and I tend to agree with that. But they're going outside of the church, not so much for gals, but for lots of other reasons, which does make it harder for the women in the church today. But I think one big curious thing, and this is the time span, is we have this thing of adolescence, which is, first of all, relatively new in the history of humanity, a new development, but also the extended adolescence of into 20s. I mean, typically, not that long ago, a couple would meet in high school, you know, and they would be in church together, in Sunday school together, and they'd start to kind of make the connection. And in their early 20s, they would decide whether they were going to marry or not marry. Now we have this whole span of this, you know, 10-year period within the 20s of where the guy can go off and exit out into the world. And women are still in the church wondering, hey, where have all the guys gone? Mm-hmm. And that hookup, if you will, that connection, if you will, didn't happen earlier. And it provides more opportunity for the men just to wander and the women to think, okay, where have the guys gone? I don't think we can put that genie back in the bottle in terms of, okay, well, let's start getting people paired up for marriage, you know, by the time they're out of high school. I don't necessarily agree with that. But I think there's something there that we do need to pay attention to and be mindful of.
Mm-hmm. I think it goes back to the discipleship issue that we talked about early on, is that I think guys within that context of understanding relationships, because of that stronger adolescence and the way they've been discipled. Mm. I mean, some of the movements that have happened with some of the books on dating, the super virginity, I Kiss Dating Goodbye, a lot of those have created, in my view, a little bit of confusion for guys. And he even added to the adolescence and extending that period of time, where before you may have had earlier generations mentoring say, hey, it's good to get married, find a good wife.
Yeah.
Now you hear a lot of the mantra with the guys is, dude, go live it out. I mean, and mm-hmm. be single as long as you can, because being married actually can hurt your ministry. I mean, I've heard these from college
sure.
campus mm-hmm. leaders.
Yeah.
And so a guy's kind of in this quandary and goes, well, I kind of like girls, but man, I should really kiss dating goodbye. And so I'm going to just put that aside so I can be sold out for Christ. So even the good guys are, I would say, kind of confused within that relational space.
Mm-hmm. So do you think there needs to be more, how can you encourage that in a healthy way within the church? I mean, should there be more hand-holding and more asking out and more kissing and more, as you said, sardines in the dark with the youth group, Travis? We know you want to do that. But what, whoa. I mean, how can you do that without then catering to the predators and the other guys who are just there trying, you know, because all the girls will say, oh yeah, it's just, you know, all these Mac daddies just come in and it's all about a meat market and they're just trolling for girls. Where's the balance?
Wow, that's a great question. And I do believe that the answer can be found within this concept of having good guys and good mm-hmm. good mentors who understand what healthy sexuality is within young boys and young gals, and understand and be able to have healthy conversations.
Yeah.
That if, you know, you see some of these things going on in youth group, not saying that you have to like abolish, hey, you know what, if we see any guys next to any girls, boom, we're mm-hmm. going to kick you out of youth group. But if there is some of those healthy
yeah.
components, being able to have a conversation with a guy, hey, I noticed that you were with Jennifer a little bit. What's going on there? And have a good conversation about it without, and talk about it maturely rather than here's the wall, you cross it, you're toast. And then they carry that throughout. Mm-hmm. And then guys do. They go, man, I can't live in this with that wall.
Yeah.
And so I better either. I mean, that could be a reason that guys...
And see, that strong leadership among the peers, guys, is to say, you know, for trollers coming into the church is like, you know what, we're not going to tolerate that. You're not treating our sisters well, and you're out of here. And for the younger guys to see that kind of thing of, okay, here's what it takes to be a good man. You're respectful to women. You're interested in them. You pursue them, but you pursue them in a respectful sort of way, in an honoring sort of way. And I think that comes down to good guy leadership and us holding up that leadership. And even comes to the church leader saying, okay, you know, Frankie over there is a quiet guy, But he's a good Christian leader. He's, you know, guys, follow his example rather than, you know, necessarily the macho jock guy who's real popular and things. I think we need to hold up good male leadership, and that comes from other men talking about what's good and what's not good.
Well, and even in relationship context, I think that it's kind of a void within churches even to talk about relationships. I mean, I remember growing up and having conversations with youth leaders where they would be like, hey, so do you kind of like her? Mm-hmm. You know, what's going on? I'm seeing something kind of cool. And there would be almost an encouragement toward relationships even through those high school years. Yeah. I mean, obviously they weren't saying—
in a healthy way.
Yeah, it wasn't— right. They weren't saying, hey, let's get you into the backseat of a car.
Yeah.
They were just saying, I noticed right. some fun things between you and this girl.
Yeah, let me help you pursue that.
I think we have trended too far in the other direction of just, you know, no, we want you to be extra spiritual, so let's not talk about this at all. That's kind of what you were saying,
exactly.
Travis.
Exactly, so. Right, yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, what it seems like, you know, just as we wrap here, is that, first of all of you need to take this discussion right here and play it for every man in your church, basically. Like, go to whoever. Go to
We'd
the elders.
We'd love to figure this out.
Go to the elders, go to the men's group, go to whoever, because I think men need to realize that we need more men in ministry within the church, and we need it especially with the youth, because I was telling you guys before we started taping, I do not want my nephews to time out of church and to exit really 16, 17 years of church experience, not having any personal connections with older men, mm-hmm. not having any understanding of the gospel and how it applies to their own life and how it really is relevant and healthy and fun and exciting, you know, how it impacts them. And for some reason, that is happening. And it seems like what you guys are saying is we've got to move away from church being this consumeristic kind of variety show, Ed Sullivan, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And somehow these guys have to have buy-in into this being part of their experience, and it matters, and there are people that care about them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, and whatever we women could do to help foster that.
Yeah, actually, next week we'll have part two to this article on the website with some of David's solutions and ideas of what single women can do to help the issue, but also how churches can maybe restructure or try some different things. So. Hmm.
As our month of contention continues. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that'll be good. Well, thank you guys very much for weighing in on this.
You're most welcome.
I think it's awesome. Hey, everyone. I am here in the studio with Dr. Wes Stafford. Wes, so great to have you here at Focus on the Family. Welcome.
Thanks, Lisa. It's good to be here. Just call me Wes.
Okay. We'll call you Wes. Not
if you call me Dr. Stafford, people think I'm going to say something smart, and that just doesn't happen very often.
Okay. Well, that brings me to my first question. Now, everyone knows that, you know, they know you as Wes Stafford, president of Compassion International. Probably some of our audience thinks that you founded Compassion because you've, you know, let's be honest, maybe you were there before some were even born who are listening to
this. I have been there longer than Jesus walked on the planet. I have been there for
You're just synonymous with 34 years, so much like him.
Well, I've been there 34 years.
Oh, my word.
But Compassion is 60 years old, so I came along when it was about halfway to where it is now.
Okay. Well, and this brings my first question here. I need to find out, this is because inquiring minds want to know, why is your name Wesley and you spell Wes with two S's? What is this about?
That's an extremely good, spelling was always my worst. But you know, it was Wes with S for Stafford. And I kept writing it like that, and people kept blending it together. So I finally said, you know what? Let me just make it not an abbreviation. Let's just make it a name. Who's going to put three S's in a row?
Wow.
So it wound up Wes, and then Stafford is the third S.
I guess you can do that when you're president of Compassion. You can just change your name. You can make all these.
You can do whatever you want. No, I did that when I was actually about 20 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there you know, folks. Now you know the truth.
It's not
that.
It's not just that I can't spell.
Right.
Although that is also true.
Well, that's good, because this will keep people from emailing us over and over again. Yeah. You know, I can't listen to this interview until I know that. So that's good.
There it is.
Okay. Well, I want to mention that you spoke to our employees today in our employee chapel. And so we had to nab you afterwards to talk to our boundless audience, because, you know, folks, we want to let you in on these folks when we have them pass through Focus. We're doing our best to give you know, give your ears that chance. So, but Wes, you grew up in West Africa, and you talk about, you now have authored two books, mm-hmm. and I know we've even heard from folks who read Too Small to Ignore, your first one, and just recently published Just a Minute, and just in reading that, it was really fun. I was telling my friends the other night, I went and watched the new Muppets movie, one that came out like around Christmas. I saw it in the Dollar Theater. And then I read Just a Minute, and I was like, between the Muppets and reading Just a Minute, it was kind of a tear fest, because in different ways, you know. The Muppets are very near and dear to my heart because I grew up with them in the 70s and the 80s. And then, of course, this is like a story. How many stories?
68
stories contained within this book. Of really how we as adults can impact the lives of children with what we think might be a throwaway encounter, but really you're saying just a minute can affect a child for a lifetime, for good or bad. Yep. Now, you grew up in West Africa. You were in MK on the Ivory Coast, and we had a chance to chat here about my parents being missionaries and kind of share some stories there. And you talk a lot, and you mentioned some of your own story, and I think it's amazing how you say that there's a good portion of your story that you didn't share until well into adulthood. And I know I first encountered it in an article in Christianity Today where they shared your story, and it was really excerpted from what you had written before and spoken on. Life was great when you were at home, but then you went to boarding school.
Yeah, every year of my childhood was split between, it was like the best of times, the worst of times. Mm-hmm. The best of times was only 3 months out of every year. Mm-hmm. But it was a poverty-stricken village of remarkably gracious, kind people. I think one of the reasons why I fight so hard for the poor with compassion is I know them. My values were, my character was shaped by them. So for 3 months out of every year, they built me up. As they built up their own children. I was just one of the kids in the village. But for 9 months out of the year, it was mission policy that all of us West African kids took off to one boarding school. It took a week to drive there by truck. It was, and then we stayed there for 9 months out of each year, never saw our parents at all during that time, rarely saw anybody other than those adults who were assigned to the school. You know, being away from home 9 months is a pretty painful thing. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the worst thing about this place. This was a place that was in a tiny, it was a tiny little place in a big jungle. No roads ever came through there. It was basically the idea, I think, in mission policy was, so let's get the kids out of the way so the gospel can go forth. And so we sort of got warehoused up there. The people, the great tragedy is the people who were in charge of us didn't want to be in charge of us. That's not what they went to Africa to do. They went there to save souls.
Mm-hmm. Well, they got demoted.
They didn't either learn the language or they didn't make it cross-culturally. They got demoted. Mm-hmm. And they were given just, you don't fire a missionary. They have their own salary support. So you simply give them the least important thing there is to do. And essentially, these people were told, well, then just go take care of other people's kids. So they didn't want to be doing it. They weren't trained to do it. They weren't called to do it. Nobody was watching how they did it. And in their anger and frustration, they just took it out on us kids. So for 9 months out of every year, it was an Auschwitz for little children. It was a terrible place to be a little child.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about, I loved how you shared today in chapel about that pivotal time when you were 6 years old and talking with your dad and seeing kids in the village dying really of the measles, and you recognizing that the reason you weren't was because you'd been vaccinated. And that was a pivotal time for you in recognizing, I'm going to do something someday to change that.
Exactly.
But then when you were 10, you had a moment in time that was not good, but also pivotal.
The whole concept of the book is just minutes mm-hmm. matter. Mm-hmm. And at this school, let me take a little minute to spin out what was going on. Horrible things were going on. The very people who were supposed to be taking care of us were hurting us, and older kids picking up, being victims themselves, were passing it on. So spiritually and emotionally and physically, I mean, when I was 9 years old, I did the math and realized I was being beaten 17 times a week in that place. Hmm. And then sexually as well. And there was no place to run for protection. We wrote letters every week, but they warned us, don't tell what happens here. And they would check every letter so you couldn't put out an SOS. And their words were, if you tell how unhappy you are, what happens to you here, you'll ruin your parents' ministries. There will be Africans in hell because of you, is literally how they used to say it to us. So us kids, you know, we wrote letters. To this day, it's hard for me to put a pen on a paper because I did that every week, lying, telling my parents everything I could dream up that was good. When we went home for the 3 months, they warned us, now we can't control you now, but nothing changes. You tell your parents, and there will be your African buddies from your village in hell. So ironically, I mean, not ironically, but tragically, they silenced all of us kids. Now that I'm all grown up, I read child psychology things, and it's amazing the amount of hurt and pain, abuse that a child will absorb to protect the people that they love. Well, this led up to this moment, this minute, actually, because I was in America on furlough for a year. Even a year, my sister and I didn't breathe a word to our parents. But finally, we're at the airport, ready to go back to Africa. Us, about 20 of us kids are going by plane. The rest of them, the parents are coming with the stuff by boat. One of the great tragedies at the school was they wouldn't let us have any pictures of our parents. So the first month of every nine-month stretch, when I went to sleep at night, I closed my eyes, all I saw was my parents' face. I'd cry myself to sleep every night. You couldn't get caught crying. That was good for another beating. But by the ninth month, I couldn't remember what they looked like. And I was always so afraid, I'm going to break their hearts when we go back. I'm not going to know who's my parents. So with that history and all this silence, I'm saying goodbye to my mother at the New York airport. And little nine-year-old me, I take her face in my hands and I look her in the eye, and I looked a little bit too long. And she said, what are you doing, Wes? And I said, Mommy, I just don't want to forget what you look like. Mm-hmm. Well, what mother wouldn't burst into tears? And she did. And I saw a moment, maybe for rescue. And in about 30 seconds, I blurted out, they hate me, they beat me, Mama, please don't send me, please. She had this look of horror on her face. She had always believed we were happy. That's all we had ever convinced her of. But with no more time than that, we were loading the plane, and I was dragged off to the plane, and I remember looking back and seeing my mom with a shock. Well, I got off to school again, and it took her a month to come by ship with no more information than that. Well, she had a nervous breakdown, sure enough. And when they got to Africa, they turned around or sent her right back to America. And when word got, it spread across the field like wildfire. When it got to the school that Wes had told his mom had had a nervous breakdown and was sure enough in Africa, or was in America, then the house father, who now had all of his sins exposed, grabbed me, stood me up on a little chair. I'm now 10. I just had a birthday. Stood me up on a metal chair in front of my friends and said, essentially, I want you to meet Satan's tool. Look at this boy. Look at him carefully, because there's going to be Africans in hell. Because we told you don't tell. He did. Look what happens. And then he did a really diabolical thing. I don't know how much premeditation he had, but essentially he said, you can't please God and Satan, just as you can't burn a candle from both ends. And he whipped out a birthday candle, and he took his pocket knife, and he trimmed it so it had a wick at both ends, stuck it in my trembling little fingers. I'm standing on a folding chair. And lights it from both ends. And he says, you want to serve God and Satan? Watch what happens when you try to do this, burn a candle at both ends. And it was the most amazing thing, because I had always been his victim. He was big, I was small. He was a man, I was a boy. He could beat me as much or as long as he wanted. I had no rescue. But this, for the very first time, gave me a level playing field. This drama could play out in a way that I could finally win. And I had a desperate thought, I'm not dropping this. I'm hanging on to this candle, and I could win finally. Well, I said it. You can't imagine the rage, the passion of a little 10-year-old boy with, you know, years and years of daily hurt in his life. So I determined I would hang on. Well, he turned his back to me, to my other 49 little friends, and went on and on about how hot hell is and how Africans. And I clenched every muscle, my jaws, and I pinched that candle, and I thought, I'm not dropping this. I'm not dropping this. After a while, I couldn't even hear what he was saying anymore, because I could just hear the blood pounding in my ears. And I watched. This is the level of rage I had. I watched that thing burn until my two sides of my thumb and my finger turned red, then bubble, and then a little whiff of smoke from either side, when all of a sudden I was had an out-of-body experience of some kind. I was up above. I remember I was up over here to my right looking down on that little boy. And I wasn't feeling that anymore. It was like it was happening to someone else. When one of the kids jumped up, slapped it out of my hand, everybody screamed and scattered. And I was left standing on that chair all by myself in that room. And I thought, I did it. I went from his victim to a little bit of victory here. And as I climbed down from that chair, I said, that's what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. I am going to fight for little children, like all my buddies. I am going to speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. And I did. Those two worlds, the broken heart at the loss of my little friends to poverty and the broken heart at the loss of other friends to abuse, welded my spirit into a warrior. And that's why I'm at Compassion for 34 years. I have been fighting on behalf of children. Both of those books are all about raising the esteem of children and all the roles that we can do to do that. And those are 2 minutes of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do you think, Wes, because I think a lot of people now think of you and just the role that you have and really the lives that you have touched. But what would you say in looking back, what was your parents' legacy to you in that? Because I think, you know, you think of your mom and broken hearing that her son, you know, many, many missionary couples, I'm sure, had similar, you know, we've heard of what's happened in various boarding schools, you know, back decades ago and stuff. And a lot of kids, you know, had to go through counseling years and years, and the parents feel responsible, feel guilty. But I'm sure you don't feel that way. What do you feel your parents left to you?
I don't. You know, I know that my parents didn't know. Mm-hmm. Witness the fact that the minute my mother knew, she has a nervous breakdown. The minute my father got to Africa after he sent mom home, he stayed, by the way, he organized the mission. They went up in pickup trucks, and basically the school was shut down. Mm-hmm. Within a year, they had built another school in the Ivory Coast, which was much, much closer to home, where kids only went for 3 months, and they put people in charge of it who wanted to be in charge of it. And so I feel like my father stepped in and rescued the minute he knew that the horrible things were happening. You know, a couple of years later, it was time for furlough again, and my folks stayed home with us. That was not understood by the missionary community. What? You can't trust God with your kids? And my parents said, we think our kids are now our highest priority. Hmm. Now, the kids that I grew up with, not everyone had parents like that. Not everyone had the nurturing village that I had. And when we are now grownups, you know, we Facebook each other. We talk about these things. Most of them call me Joseph. My nickname is Joseph. What those guys meant for evil, God somehow redeemed for good to save many lives. But the way they say it is, you know, when Abraham's love was being tested and God said, will you give up your son in service and love to me? At the last minute, there was a ram in the bulrushes that was the substitute sacrifice. In our case, there was no ram in the bulrushes. We were the ones sacrificed for the advancement of the gospel. Mm-hmm. And many of them have not gotten over that.
Wow. So how do we understand, because I think there's such a movement now among young adults to, you know, and Compassion is a hugely popular ministry for young adults. It's something tangible. I mean, everyone knows, you know, I want to help these kids. When they go to conferences, whether it's Catalyst or Passion, you know, it's like, I want to sponsor a kid, and many do. Right. But how do we keep the gospel infused in this kind of ministry when a lot of people, you know, there are so many, I mean, even celebrities have social justice causes and they're out there and they're making it the next best thing or the super sexy opportunity to go and do something good, but still, how do we keep the gospel in this kind of ministry?
Well, if you understand poverty, and that's exactly what Compassion is attacking, the worst thing about poverty is not having a well, not having a house, not having raw sewage. Those are all the symptoms of poverty, and they should be fixed. I mean, I love that organizations go out there and fix that, but that's not enough. Doing good is not good enough. If you really understand poverty the way I know it from having grown up in it and now got a PhD in this field, the worst thing about poverty is the inside message that poverty brings to a little child's heart. And essentially, it's a message that says, give up. Nobody cares about you. Nobody's coming to your rescue. Look at your grandpa. Look at your daddy. Nothing ever good happened. So give up. Well, I don't know about you, but that is the antithesis of the gospel. You're not important. Well, yeah, you are. God knows how many hairs are on your head. Nobody's coming to your rescue. Yeah, they are. God's people, the pastor, the people, are, it's somebody all the way across the world in Denver is coming to your rescue. So don't give up. And so Compassion's ministry, while we are breaking the back of poverty, we are doing it with a remarkable tool of the message of the gospel. You do matter. God does know your name. God does know the pattern of your fingerprints. You really, really matter. So I don't, and what we do ultimately with a sponsor all the way across the world is encourage them to join us in this. The letters that they send can reinforce the preciousness of each child, because we take them all the way from 3 and 4 years old, right on through school. Little successes cause them to begin to believe in themselves. They win a blue ribbon once in a while. They survive measles. They get from first grade to second grade. When they get to be adolescents, it's really a kick, because now you can see the confidence, the twinkle in their eye, and they'll say, you want to know what I think? I'll tell you what I think. I don't think my community should look like this. And I don't think people should treat each other like that. And you see this over here? That's wrong. And I think I can fix that. When a child goes from, I am hopelessly trapped, I don't matter, to, I can actually make my world a better place, you've just won the war on poverty. And I maintain it begins with a love of Jesus Christ lived out by that little village church and a sponsor all the way across in America somewhere. And it ends with the love of God lived out by that child's life. It is the most loving yet strategic attack on poverty that there exists. And I maintain at the very center of it is the gospel. I can tell you with complete confidence that today, 450 children are going to accept Jesus Christ as their Savior somewhere across Compassion's ministry, at the knee of their pastor or with a Sunday school teacher under a mango tree somewhere. That happens every single day, 164,000. Wow. Now, once they've accepted Christ as their Savior, the rest of the task is discipling them to reach their full God-given potential and leave poverty behind and be a blessing to their communities and their nations.
And there are so many stories of that, again, as we said on the front end of this in the book, Just a Minute, which we would encourage you all to get for sure. What about that young adult that's just sitting somewhere in Ohio, Wes, and just, you know, they're an accountant, they're going into work every day, and maybe they do have a relationship with, whether it's a younger brother or sister, niece and nephew, someone at their church. What, you know, we're so about being intentional here at Boundless, intentional towards marriage, intentional in church, intentional in mentoring relationships. How can we be intentional in having these 1 minute moments with kids? How do we even see them in our sphere?
Yep. Well, it would take more time than we have, but you're right. We should hunt down this book.
Yes.
I can tell you, you know, first of all, I'm keeping nothing out of this book, so it's not like I have something to promote, to line my own pockets. All of the money the book makes is going to Compassion Children, to, you know, to help them. But I encourage, basically, you know, the premise of the book is that if God stands a child in front of you for as little as a minute, it might be a divine appointment. You might be the one to make the memory that lasts a lifetime. Say the right thing, do the right thing. And so what I encourage people to do in the book basically is, first of all, reflect on your own life. Who do you owe for who you are? You know, who believed in you long before you believed in yourself? Do you remember where you were? Do you remember what they said? Do you remember what they did upon which you've built your life? I mean, surely somebody said, my, but you're a pretty little girl. And now here you are in your mid-20s. And when you look in the mirror, you're like, yeah, I am pretty. Or you treasure that part of you. Or someone said, my, but you're a brave young man. I saw how you stood up for that little child on the playground. And now you're always using your strength and your courage to speak up and to fight the battles of the little ones around you. Or my, but you're generous, and now you delight in giving. Somewhere, these core values of who you are came from. Now, some of it was surely knit in your mama's womb by God himself. Your DNA was knit by God. But there are people that you probably owe, if you take just a few minutes and ponder back, who am I? What do I care about? What are my basic values? Where did these come from? And if you go back in the book, actually, and I think it's chapter 8, guides you, sit down in front of a mirror if you've never done that before. And I know the women have, but us guys, we don't do that. You know, I stand in front of a mirror every day, but I never actually make eye contact with this guy.
Okay.
But nobody knows you like you know yourself, and you can fool everybody else, but you know yourself. And basically, I guide you through a 30-minute appointment with yourself. What should you look at in your eyes? What should you ask? And find your way back. And then what I'm trying to cause is a wave of gratitude. So find that teacher, find that coach, find that grandma, grandpa, find that person that you owe and thank them. You can Google them. You can hunt down anybody right now. Mm-hmm. But then what I'm trying to do is get people to say, then this is going to be my cause. I am going to pass on the blessing that I received. And so, you know, if you've got little children of your own, be aware of what your words, your actions might do when you put them to bed at night. What a precious time to breathe hope into them. I almost said in chapel today, but of course we ran out of time. I used to be the one to put my daughters to bed, Jenny and Katie. And I had to tell a story to them every night. And they always had to begin, "When I was a little boy in Africa." And I would tell them another Africa story. But as we moved on, I finally said, "Can I tell you other stories?" And I would tell stories. I'd say, "Once upon a time, there was a beautiful princess who had a beautiful white horse. And she lived in the Black Forest." And I would see how far could I get into the story before one of my daughters would say, "Hey, Daddy, you're talking about me." Mm-hmm. And I would say, "You're right, sweetheart. This is your story tonight." And I would talk about this princess who had one cookie and how she broke it in half and gave the bigger part to her sister, which is I had seen Katie do that day. And I would say, "Wow, Katie, I saw you do that. I am so proud of you." And I would use stories to breathe into my daughters things that I wanted to affirm and encourage. So you got your own children, but many of us who are not yet married, we still got aunts, we still got nieces and nephews, we've got neighbors. And what I'm encouraging people to do is be alert to the children that you know well and think, what could I say, what could I do that might lift them up, encourage them? And then, you know, the really fun part, I think, is to be ready to do this for any child that you run into, even for a minute. Look, I'm wearing a Mickey Mouse watch. I lead a $600 million organization, and I'm sitting here with a Mickey Mouse watch. Why would I do that? Well, first of all, not to take myself too seriously. But secondly, anytime I check for the time, I immediately look up and say, is there a child in the vicinity? And is there anything I might say or do? If I'm in a grocery store and there's a child in the cart in front of me, I can say, "Wow, did you help mommy load that up? What a big girl you are." Or if a little young man holds a door open for me, I'm like, "Wow, I wonder how strong you're going to be when you grow up." I mean, you can, in a minute, say something that might just launch that child's life. And I'm just trying to cause a wave, first of all, of gratitude for those of us who've received moments like that, and then a commitment to say, you know what, that's the kind of person I'm going to be. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bless any child that God brings across my path. Mm-hmm. And we don't dare say, "Well, you know, I don't understand kids. Kids aren't my thing." I'm like, right. Excuse me. Yeah. I think I told you guys this morning, you spent 9,500,000 minutes being a child. You're an expert on childhood. You know childhood. There's nothing more you need to know. You just need to have a heart tenderized that says, "I'm going to pass on the blessing I've received."
Yeah. Well, and the two children upon whom you've probably had the most impact, you already talked about them a little bit, Jenny and Katie, young adults themselves.
You are someone
I always love to talk to folks when they're in our studio who have had the chance to impact young adults, and especially in a parenting way. Mm. What would you say for them? I mean, did you have any fears navigating them toward adulthood, or what do you see as far as that impact of those stories and what you told them? How has that grown them into the women they are today?
Well, you know, my greatest fear when I stepped into Compassion 34 years ago, I knew from the chair, and I knew from the village that I was going to fight for children. So I knew that my preoccupation ministry-wise was going to be children. And my wife, Donna, married me in Haiti. I don't know what she was thinking. But we sat down right away and said, you know what? If we pour ourselves into the children of the world, but if God gives us any of our own, let's promise that they will never be able to say to us, well, you loved all the rest of the children, but you forgot us. Mm. And so at the minute Jenny was born first, and then 4 years later, Katie, I have worked harder at Papa than I have President. I committed myself that when I am home, I am really home. I am the one who puts them to bed at night. I am the one who breathes every opportunity I can into them. And if I'm gone, I want them to know that I would always rather be with them than wherever I am. And this was long before the days of, emails and anything else. And so I just poured myself into my daughters. We used to do meals on wheels. I would take them out and we would deliver meals every Thanksgiving to the elderly because I wanted my children to sit with elderly people and to listen to their stories and to learn to respect people of all levels. We sponsored children ourselves for our children. I mean, way more than I can afford. Emmanuel, Renee, Diego, Laura, Alba, Mercedes, Yolanda, Vanessa, Cisai, Fatoin. It went on until my wife used to say, step away from those tables. We don't have that much money. But I engaged my children in caring for the children of the world. So it's what we prayed about. The reason I can list them, we listed them every night. Mm-hmm. And whenever I was traveling and met one of those kids, I would come back and say, Katie, let me tell you about Mercedes. Let me tell you about Renee. And I didn't let the ministry pull me away from these kids. So our kids did, they did little chores around the house. And when they got a little allowance, some of it they were able to keep. The rest of it went into the jar on our kitchen table for the kids that we sponsored. Mm. And we would gather the letters that these kids sent us. And once a month, we would sit down at the breakfast nook and say, okay, Jenny, you write to this one. And Katie, you write to this one. And this one's getting kind of older. I'll write to him. And we prayed about them. We had their pictures on our refrigerator. Our kids knew that when they got up to get a midnight snack, not every kid in the world can do that. And so those of us who can, first of all, have to be grateful that we're among those who can. But secondly, we've got to do something about those who can't. And so probably the biggest success, if you will, of my life is that I raised two young girls while I was passionate about the children of the world who never felt left behind. And now, they're 24 and 29. They are the most wonderful. They're my best friends. They come home every chance we have for holidays. We would rather sit and sip coffee from breakfast till the middle of the afternoon than do anything else because we invested in them. Mm-hmm. And now it's a huge, huge joy.
It's amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Wes Stafford, for chatting with us, chatting with our audience, giving us a little insight into yourself, as well as the great work of Compassion and what you're doing. And our hope, and we'll give a shout out on the blog and just get stories from those. I know, like I said, we have many who do sponsor kids through Compassion.
And thank you, all of you, by the way.
Yeah. And also many who would probably want to call in and say, let me tell you the story of my kid and what I heard and how they wrote to me. And but we really want to infuse all of you out there, and I hope you did sense that here today with the understanding, first of all, that you matter. It doesn't matter if you're, 25 or 30 or whatever. Maybe you haven't heard that enough as a young adult or when you were growing up and you came from a broken past. But know that. But then, too, how you can, regardless of what you've done before, how you really can start pouring into the lives of kids in a very tangible way. So,
With your audience, it'd be really cool thing. If you go to justaminute.com, that's a website where we've all decided to gather to tell our stories.
Oh, yeah.
So if you want to read the stories of other people who've read Just a Minute and now want to tell their moment, there we gather. Those who are inspired to do something for a child, you can read, here's what I tried and here's how it looked. And also there's guides for if you're in a small study group or something, maybe you ought to sometime, maybe you read this book, but then tell each other start with your good stories. Yeah. The ones that, and then as you get to grow in your trust, maybe you share the hard stories like the candle stories. Mm-hmm. Either way, we need each other in our lives. Mm-hmm. And justaminute.com is a pretty cool place to find else like you.
And the book is Just a Minute, and then don't forget Too Small to Ignore as well. And you can also find out more about Compassion at compassion.com. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Yeah, Les. It's my privilege, Lisa. Thank you.
The wheels have lifted. This great expanse.
Well, hey, everyone. We are opening up this week's inbox, and on the phone I have John Thomas. John.
Hey, Lisa.
Hey, thanks for taking a break from your increasingly busy camp schedule heading into the summer to talk with us.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. We're getting excited about the summer.
I know. You know what, though? You need to find out, how are you going to just moderate the humidity down there? Because that, you know, do you have just people...
Man, if I could figure that out, it would change the world down here for sure.
Yeah. Well, but you know what? It's good.
It's just not summer camp unless it's like 110% humidity.
That's good. It gives them, people can make memories with that.
Yeah.
So that's good. Well, we have a great question for you today, and I'm going to start it off here by just reading it. This person's saying, a guy, bless his heart, do you have any advice for someone who is deemed the nice brother in Christ, but never the boyfriend material guy? I always feel like I'm overlooked, and I'm afraid of being passed by.
Yeah, I mean, we hear this from both genders, don't we, quite a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, girls say the same thing, guys say this. I have a couple of thoughts. One is this: if you are in high school and early years of high school, or even late years of high school, and you think this, I would say don't waste another minute worrying about it. You know, it really doesn't matter at a really young age,
mm-hmm.
when you're not in a marriageable season and you're not looking for that in your life. You're too young for it. Don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. There's no need to be a serial, you know, serial boyfriend or even a boyfriend once in a while. Things change so much, so quickly, from those years into the college years and beyond. And Lisa, we don't know how old the guy is that wrote this, but I at least wanted to put that little disclaimer in there. That, you know, at a really young age, that sort of observation is not something I would be too concerned about. If you are of marriageable age and you're in a season where, you know, marriage is something that people would expect you to be thinking about, that you're thinking about, then that's a different topic. So let's talk about that one, okay?
Yep.
So here's a couple of things that I wonder. First of all, that you could be, you know, just such a great guy and such a great friend that you're making yourself too available as a friend, and therefore not giving any girl a reason to want to look at you any other way. Mm-hmm. Part of what having a relationship is, you know, being available and being emotionally available and all these other things. And so sometimes I wonder if guys who are just such buddies with so many girls aren't being too much buddy-buddy and therefore just always seen as a friend and never someone who might be considered, you know, somebody in more of a romantic relationship. So first thing I would do is just caution against that. And have you take a look at how you are conducting yourself when you're in these circles, and consider that you might need to be less of a friend. If I'm making sense with that, does that make sense to you, Lisa?
Yeah, definitely.
That you might just say, wait a minute, I'm presenting myself as just, and I don't mean this in any offensive way, just one of the gals.
Mm-hmm.
Just a friend that I can always be called on, and I'm a good guy, and I'll go change all the flat tires you know, drive you here and there and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because girls like a little bit of mystery, too. You know, I think some guy that's just putting himself way too much out there and, like you said, just being kind of everything to everyone. Yeah, it's just kind of like,
right.
What? Yeah.
Because there's one of two things are happening here. Either A, you are the kind of guy that somebody would want to marry, and these girls just don't see that, or B, you aren't that kind of guy, and you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So in either of those situations, I think in the first situation is if you're a great guy, and you're a great catch, and you carry yourself in such a way, I mean, girls that are serious about marriage will not pass you by. But the second part is the one that I am thinking and more concerned about is this. Do you think that you're marriage material, but you're not? And what I mean by that is, are you developing in godly manhood? Are you growing and maturing as a leader, someone who a girl would look at and say, wow, this guy could lead a home. He'd be a great husband. He would be a great father. The way he carries himself is the kind of guy any Christian girl would love to have. That's the thing I'm gonna sort of put my finger on and say, I would look at yourself there. Because, Lisa, and correct me if I'm wrong, if a girl sees a guy who is all these things, are they going to pass him by very quickly?
No.
I wouldn't think so.
No.
So either you are those things and the girls don't see it, which means you need to carry yourself a little bit differently around them, or you think you're those things, but you're not, and you need to take a look at yourself and say, well, what do I need to do to show that I am serious about manhood, I'm serious about husbandhood, I'm serious about fatherhood? And I would say those are some issues of discipleship, mentoring, and really being kind of sober-minded about that. And I think once that you sort of begin to focus on that part of your heart and life, you will not be passed by.
Yeah.
Unless there's some other serious issue that, you know, probably needs some sort of counseling or something like that. But I'm guessing that's not the case. I'm thinking that maybe there's a way that he's carrying himself that needs to change.
Yeah, well, those are good thoughts. And I would also say that that's probably something that most guys are going to need someone else to point out for them. They're not going to be self-aware enough to know that, because either they've trended, you know, that way growing up, or they just have a blind spot, or they just, you know, there is some area where they need to mature or they need to step up or something like that. So definitely get someone else, an objective person to tell you.
Yeah, and I don't want to be critical of this guy because, you know, I don't know anything about him personally or who he is. But if he's taking cues from the world and from media on what to be to attract a girl, he's not going to attract a good girl. You know, he's not going to attract the kind that he wants to marry, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's not only is it critical that you sort of look to see what you need to be, but also look in the right place to see that.
Right. And if he's wearing skinny jeans, he's just sealed his fate. So that's just the first step right there. So
I'm not going to go that far.
I'm just saying. So, well, awesome. Thank you so much, John. That is it for this week's show. We want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org so we can get your question in on a future show or get your response to this one. Maybe you've had personal experience in this arena. So for the time being, make sure you're catching up on past shows and getting ready for future ones as well. And we will see you around next time. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.
A donor-supported ministry of Focus on the Family.